Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. Happy Sakadawa! In honor of this sacred day commemorating the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and parinirvana, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg recalls his life and his teachings, particularly his thoughts on hope and fear, the eight worldly concerns. We also continue with our series on the lives of the Karmapas, today looking at the 10th and 11th Karmapas, who worked skillfully and patiently in a time of enormous political upheaval. There were great losses in those times at the hands of the Mongol horde, in part due to corruption in the Tibetan noble and religious bureaucracies. The lives of these Karmapas are a powerful demonstration of fortitude and how cutting through the entanglements of hope and fear, the eight worldly concerns, ultimately brings enormous benefit. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, originally, on the schedule, we're supposed to be talking about the 10th and 11th Karmapas this morning, because we're going through this book, History of the Karmapas. Then Lama Kathy texted me three things to remember, one of which was that I have this talk to give. The second was something else. And then the third was, oh, and by the way, it's Sakadawa. Sakadawa is like the holiest day in the Buddhist year. It's like Easter or, you know, Yom Kippur or Ramadan or whatever. It's like, this is it. Because this is the day, literally today, where on the lunar calendar we celebrate the birth, enlightenment, and death of the Buddha all at once. So it's really notable that you showed up here. It's incredibly wonderful and auspicious, because the teachings say that anything that you do on this day, is the merit is multiplied by like 100,000 times or a million times or some incredible number like that. So just showing up to hear the Dharma is very meritorious. And just remember that there's a lot of merit, and so dedicate a lot of merit for the benefit of beings. That's probably the most important thing. The second thing is that, you know, there are a lot of ways to dedicate merit. There's pilgrimage, and so Lama Kathy and a bunch of people from here are up at Karmaling right now for the annual retreat, and that's meritorious. There's doing a little extra meditation. There's keeping the precepts. There's remembering mantra during the day, like just simple Om Mani Padme Hum. Just carry it in your heart all day. The precepts are... Do you all know the precepts? This is like the basic Buddhist precepts are not killing, not stealing. Stealing's really interesting definition. It's not just like shoplifting or something, or ripping off a bank, you know, that kind of thing. It's taking what is not given. In other words, if there's something that you want and it's not yours and it's just sitting there, don't take it. Allow it to be given. Not misusing sex, not lying, and not abusing intoxicants. In other words, don't make yourself stupid today on whatever your intoxicant of choice may be. Those are the five, what are called the five lay precepts. So the Karmapas, all of them, are considered to be emanations of the Buddha. Karmapa actually means activity of the Buddha. That's what it means. So when we think of enlightenment, we think of really in terms of the way we see it in our ordinary mundane life, we see it as qualities. You know, we see somebody who walks into a room and brings a certain lightness to it, a certain sense of peacefulness to it, has a certain magnetic quality where you just want to be around them, just feels good, you know, just that warmth. So there are qualities of enlightenment, and there are also activities of enlightenment. And the activities of enlightenment are actually what's going on. You know, it's like, okay, this situation simply needs to be pacified. We all got to settle down. And karmapas are remarkably good at that, or it needs enrichment. There needs to be teaching here, or there needs to be more resources here. There's a story about the 16th karmapa, which was the first karmapa to come here. Interestingly enough, back in the, I think it was 8th century, 9th century, something like that, Guru Rinpoche wrote a prophecy that the activity of the Buddha would fly in an iron bird and arrive on the western shores and encounter his red brothers. And there's a Hopi prophecy that said that the teacher from the east would arrive and blah, blah, blah. So when the 16th Karmapa came, he literally wanted to go out west, and he met the highest ranking Hopi elder. And it was like the reuniting of two great souls. Not only that, Karmapa, being Karmapa, said, "How you doing?" Hopi guy said, "Not so good. Hasn't rained here in 97 days. Crops are failing." Karmapa says, "I'll pray." And so he did. And clouds began to gather, and they had a tremendous storm within that very day, with thunder and lightning and the whole nine yards. This is actually historical, you know, in the 20th century kind of record. So the activity of karmapas are pacification, and we'll hear a little bit about that in the time of the 10th and 11th karmapa. They're pretty good diplomats usually. And enrichment, they can bring resources, even in sometimes in miraculous ways. Then there's a kind of magnetizing energy, drawing people to seeing their own nature. They have a unique ability. So if you get to see the 17th Karmapa, who's around sometimes, he's been in this country a little bit in the last 5-10 years, and he will be again. He may even come to Columbus someday. The 16th did, by the way. Do it, because there's something just in the atmosphere that'll draw you, and it'll also plant seeds. If you're in, plant seeds of bodhicitta and your ability to actually see your own true nature. These are the activities of enlightened beings. And then there's subduing, which is the fourth enlightened activity. And subduing means actually when real problems exist, disease and all that kind of stuff, sometimes they can and will suppress epidemics or things like that. They'll subdue dark times. So it's always appropriate to remember Karmapa. And he's assured us in person that if we remember him, he'll remember us. And he's got apparently the ability to do that. The historical Buddha, sometimes called Gautama, sometimes called Shakyamuni, sometimes called Siddhartha, and all that began his quest for enlightenment when he was around 29 years old. It was sometime between 563 BCE and 483. So 2,500, 2,600 years ago. He was an actual historical figure. We've got the history stuff about that. And it's said that at that age, he had been raised in privilege and luxury and all that kind of thing. And then he saw what's called the four passing sights. He saw a sick person. He'd been protected from all this. An aged person. A corpse. And a holy man. And the whole thing troubled him a lot because it was kind of out of his frame of reference and he was upset. Just like any of us get upset with circumstances, you know, like seeing somebody sick, it's hard. Sometimes we want to look away. Sometimes when we see a corpse, we can't handle death. We think of our own death. When we see a holy person, somebody who's got what we want, we get a little jealous and a little grabby and stuff like that. Or just these four passing sights bring up what we call our kleshas, our afflictive emotions. There's a whole level of consciousness where we get trapped. Really, most of our energy gets trapped there. And that's part of what this talk today will be all about. So he took off and he started visiting yoga teachers. And he went from one to another. He'd go to one, get the good of that, and then move on to the next one and next one and next one. Until he finally engaged with five companions. There were six of them that went down to the banks of a river and just decided to practice asceticism and practice the yogas and see if they could get enlightenment. After 6 years, they say that his bones were sticking out. He never was eating. He was never drinking. He felt like he was no closer to this liberation that he sought. And one of the accounts says that he could feel his spine through the back of his stomach. Kind of interesting description. And he realized, or he remembered, that when he was a boy, sitting under a rose apple tree on a beautiful day, he actually did experience great bliss. Just simply that. I think we've all had that kind of glimpse, you know? And when he realized that, and he realized it wasn't asceticism that brought that to him, and it also wasn't the indulgences of his youth, you know, having everything handed to him on a silver platter, so to speak, he started to get this thing called the middle way, neither extreme. Just neither extreme being the path. And he meditated on that. Some people say for one day, like he got it right away. Some people say 45 days, he didn't get it right away. Either way, at some point, he recognized his physical strength had to get better. Somebody brought him some milk to drink, and he drank it. His companion saw that he was drinking milk, and they thought he had abandoned them and kind of sold them out. So they abandoned him, and he was left alone at this place we now call Bodh Gaya under a fig tree called the Bodhi tree. And by meditating on his own experience, rather than trying to get something, whether it was like his youth trying to get all the goodies that he wanted, you know, gold chariots or, you know, whatever, Rolls Royce, however, Ferrari maybe, whatever, or trying to get away from everything, just saying this is all just dross, this is all trash. and enlightenment was going to lie in something that wasn't corrupted like this world. He dropped all that. And he looked at the nature of his own experience. This is because he remembered that one experience of sitting under this rose apple tree, or what they called that. And by simply looking directly at the nature of his own experience, he had some realization. Because he'd been doing yoga so much, he had some abilities. You know, one of the things for sure is he was a good practitioner. This didn't come just because he had the right thoughts and he thought about it the right way or the right concepts or he understood it from a book. He actually had some experience. It's just his motivation was not in quite the direction of that it needed to be in order to wake up. So by applying his gifts of concentration, or I shouldn't call them gifts, his attainments of concentration, he recognized what's called the three knowledges. The first knowledge is the knowledge of all past lives, of himself and everybody else too. It's a little bit like, you know, there's an old story about a guy who finds a teacher and he goes to this teacher who's supposedly omniscient. And he says, can you tell me about my future? And the teacher says, sure, it's easy. Unless you wake up, tomorrow will feel like today. And so this whole idea of path became developed by the Buddha at this time. And he started to try to really work on how he could teach this and help beings. He realized that he had kind of crashed through some barrier, spiritual barrier, in a way that others with religious aspirations hadn't done so far. Then, of course, came the temptations. Who hasn't had that? Like something really good happens, you know, some realization, you see how it is, and then boom, all of a sudden, you know, life has its ups and downs, right? So something happens that grabs your attention and tries to drag you right back down. In the story of the Buddha, this figure is called Mara. And apologies to all people named Mara in the West. I have a cousin named Mara. She's not like this at all. And Mara is said to have sent armies of demons to attack, and he's sat untouched. He sent his most beautiful daughters to try to tempt him, and he just felt kindness and compassion for them. He didn't like try to feel the grabbiness of wanting something from them or the fear of wanting to get away from these threatening armies. He was able to remain in those four activities of pacification, enrichment, magnetization, and subduing. He just finally, Mara said, look, you're sitting on my chair. I own all this. So I think it's what in the West in theology they call being worldly. That's Mara, right? And so he said, I own all this stuff. And I have witnesses. And his whole army said, we witnessed that you own this. Buddha, you got to move. And Buddha said, well, I have witness that this is my seat. And that's when he reached down and touched the ground. And the story is the earth shook, little quake, and the earth said, I am his witness. That's why when you see representations of Shakyamuni. He often has his left hand in his lap like this and his right hand touching the earth like that. It's like this world, in this very world, he was able to achieve enlightenment in this body as an ordinary human being. And the teaching is that we're just like that too. That's the important thing. There aren't too many beliefs in Buddhism. One of them is, though, that every single one of us is a potential Buddha. Really important. So then he became a teacher. He had to figure out, you know, what to teach. And as you've heard a lot of times, he taught, do no harm to yourself or others. Practice virtue, practice goodness, and totally tame your mind. To me, that's always was upside down, because in order to do no harm, really, my mind is crazy. I do harm without even knowing I'm doing harm, you know, and then I find out about it. This is being married for 41 years. It's just the best teacher. It lets me know on a fairly constant basis how asleep I still am. But so doing no harm requires some waking up, requires practice. Practicing virtue, you know, figuring out not just to be generous, but to give the right thing at the right time in the right way. That takes insight. In order to cultivate this insight and wisdom requires taming this monkey mind. I have a guy who comes to the Wednesday meditation classes at Trinity. He says, actually, there are 13 monkeys. And there are some psychologist who's written about this now. I think that's pretty great, because that's probably more right. You know, it's not just one monkey. So I felt like just a brief talk about the historical Buddha was important on this day, because this is really Buddha Day. This is his day. The next thing is I don't know if I have enough copies. I brought like 30 copies of a sutra for each of you. We're not going to read it, but you can take it with you and read it. And if you don't get one, because there may be more than 30 people here, I don't know, you can email me at the columbuskTC.org website. You can either email to my attention, info@columbuskTC.org, or member at large. I'm member at large. So, and I'll send you a PDF of it or a Word document so you can have it. One of the fundamental, one of the important teachings of the Buddha is we've got these levels of consciousness. They're the five senses. Each of them takes in information. Virtually every bit of information that we get in life is coming through these senses. If you think about it, what do you know that you didn't get through your senses? It's pretty amazing. They're powerful. Then there's the mental consciousness, thinking about what you take in, right? Kind of putting it in order. This is this and that is that. And then below that, there's this level of consciousness called the kleshic consciousness, which is where we store all our habits and reactions to things. So it's not just that we take it in. It's like I look at all of you today and it makes me really happy. That has to do with you being there, having the facility to see, the eye that works, and then the visual consciousness in my brain being operational, and then some kind of a judgment or labeling of that makes me happy, okay? Might make somebody else unhappy, but makes me happy. That's my mental habit at this point. But beneath that, at least according to the teachings, is where we experience this deep bliss that we call enlightenment, where things become spontaneous and fresh, no matter what it is that's going on, whether it's Mara showing up trying to torture you or things happening that you really appreciate. We kind of get knotted up in this level of our reactivity. Lama Kathy's been talking about this a little bit in terms of what is the six realms. And I could bring that in, but I think I'm going to do it in a simpler way because we're doing three things today. We're talking about the life of the Buddha. We're talking about this, and we're talking about two karmapas. That's a lot. So he, in the space of his teaching, he taught for almost 50 years. He taught what's called sutras or suttas in the Pali. And I brought with me a sutta. And in this one, he explains what are like what I call the eight worldly dharmas. Some of them call them the eight vicissitudes. There's all kinds of eight this or something. And I want to talk a little bit about that and how that fits into practice and how it fits into the way we approach life and how it fits into the lives of these karmapas, because that all works. And that's what I'm going to try to accomplish today. So, remembering the Buddha and that he actually achieved what our deepest desire is for ourselves and for others and what his desire is for us, let's sing the four-line refuge prayer together. If you know it, please join me. And if you're not familiar with it, please just join in your heart, recognizing that at the core of your very being, you have the mind of awakening. And that's where to take refuge. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Tsuchi Taki Jin Soki Pe Sonam Ki Rola Pinshir Sanje Drupal Shom Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Yi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Pinshir Sanje Drupal Shom Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Yi Pe Sunam Ki Rola Pinshir Sanje Drupal Shom. So how is he going to pull all this together? I don't know. So I want you first, just take a moment and think about your own mind. What stresses you out in particular? What's suffering like for you? It's going to be different for everybody. The first, what's called the first truth of the noble ones that the Buddha taught was that life contains suffering. This word suffering in Sanskrit was actually dukkha. I like to call it dukkhi as slang for you know what. So suffering not only meaning, you know, like you dropped a brick on your toe. That's certainly suffering, but it's not just that. It's that general sense of unsatisfactoriness. And he taught suffering has a cause, and the cause is actually clinging. The clinging is interesting because what he's talking about is we're in the investigation now of who clings. Who? Well, me. Well, who's this me? Ah. Well, this me today is the same as the me yesterday unless I wake up, right? That's what we said before. And so there's a habitual day after day kind of way of looking at life. And that's what he's talking about, that we like this and we don't like that, that we chase after, desire, grab the things that we want, that we think we want, and we avoid the things we think we don't want. That's where this teaching about the eight worldly dharmas comes from. It's broken down into four pairs. It's the seeking of happiness and the avoidance of suffering. The seeking of fame and the avoidance of insignificance. The seeking of praise and the avoidance of blame. The seeking of gain and the avoidance of loss. I want you to just take a moment and think. This, I just did this myself, and it was like eye-opening for me. It, particularly when things feel bad and you're getting anxious, a little stressed out, a little nervous. What I've started to do is look for which of these things I'm trying to grab or which of these things I'm trying to get away from. Because what's happening is that the flow of my life, the energy of my life, my attention, my awareness is getting caught in something that has nothing to do with what's ultimately going on right here, right now. It's just I have a perception that, oh, I don't like this, or I really want this and I can't get it, or something like that. And what I've been finding more and more, if I relate to these feelings that I get, these little stress feelings that I get directly, and try to find what it is I'm clinging to. As the Buddha said, the clinging causes suffering, or this dukkhi kind of life. If I look directly at that and see it, I'm finding that with the application of my own daily practice, they kind of dissolve. They're like waves. So, you know, you can feel it coming on. It's growing and growing and growing. It crests, whatever that feeling is, and then it falls back into the sea. And there are waves all day. What we tend to do is really reject hard the crest of some kinds of waves, or really want hard the crest of some kind of waves. But if we just let the waves be waves, it changes our relationship to them. The waves don't stop. That's not the game. It won't happen. But our relationship to those waves can change. And so with daily practice, which is that part about Buddha waking up, if he hadn't done 6 years of practice on the river as an ascetic, he might not have had the concentration necessary for waking up. So us, with our daily practice, we're building, also building the qualities necessary for waking up. And we're also building into the activities of waking up. And sooner or later, we'll suddenly be in the middle of a wave and we'll, instead of grabbing, we're going to let go. The third truth of the Noble Ones was, because there's a cause, clinging, there's a solution. That's it. Letting go. Let that dukkha go. I always wanted to make a t-shirt. Lama Kathy will not allow this, to sell at Comfest, of Buddha sitting there with caption on the bottom, let that dukkha go. And I won't do it unless she thinks it's a good idea. But I could tell you, you know. In order to be able to do this, we do have to be a kind of attentive. We have to be awake and aware. And that's why we practice daily. And that's why there's what's called the Eightfold Path, the path of mind training, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, through things that are available to you here, you can actually kind of find the thing that fits you right now. And that will grow and change and evolve over the years. It's kind of a cool thing. And as you grow and change and evolve, your relationship to these waves coming through life changes. Somebody asked Thich Nhat Hanh Rinpoche once, who Thich Nhat Hanh is the Karmapa's guru. He asked him once, how will an old guy like me know that I'm progressing? And Thich Nhat Hanh's response to him was, when the remedy arises before the klesha, in other words, when the remedy is already there, when the wave, the wave of afflictive emotions comes, you'll know you made progress. So I think this is his way of saying, yeah, you know, do this stuff a lot so that there's another kind of wave going on in your mind. And it's this wave of let it go and returning to rest in your own nature, which is really open and really vast. And it's so clear and full of light, you can see all this stuff. That's the point. We just don't rest there when we get there. We get grabbed, our attention gets grabbed by one of these waves. So, my theory is, having read some of these biographies of the Karmapas now, they get, life doesn't get easier because you're enlightened. Actually, it looks to me like it might be more difficult. In the time of the 10th Karmapa, the great 5th Dalai Lama had come into power. And at that time, he was the religious leader of the Gelugpa lineage and was based in Lhasa, which is in central Tibet. And Karmapa was the head of the Karmakaju, which is actually bigger in the sense that there are more people, adherents at that time. But you know, there were politics. There's always these politics. And at that time, yeah, the Dalai Lama was not a political leader. He was just a spiritual leader. But he had an attendant that was kind of like the Mitch McConnell of his time, I guess. He had political power aspirations, and he wanted to control things. And even though he was the attendant of the Dalai Lama, He was a little bit wrongheaded. This can happen. He wanted to solidify political power in Tibet. And he wanted, you know, all the goodies that come with that to come to the Gelugpa lineage and so on. And so he invited the Mongols to Tibet. Yeah, one of the Khans. It's in there. I forget his name. But one of the Khans. And Karmapa at that time, 10th Karmapa, Choying Dorje was his name, saw that. And he realized that we could get spiritual unrest. We could get political unrest. There's a lot of bad stuff that could happen. And he wrote the Dalai Lama and he said, "You've got an attendant that's doing some stuff you might not even know about, and you should stop him." And he at that time had, you know, some insight and was trying to make peace. And turns out that he and the Dalai Lama at that time, the fifth Dalai Lama, did in fact do some special prayers, meditations, activities, probably political wangling, and got the Mongols to turn back. And they went away for a while. But this guy was pretty relentless. And it was 6 or 7 years later, they came back and convinced the Dalai Lama that no harm would be done to anybody. Everything's going to be okay. We just want to help you. We're going to bring resources. We're going to bring trade. We're going to bring all the goodies that you want. Karmapa realized that this wasn't exactly the case. And Dalai Lama didn't. Anyway, the Mongols came in. They took over Lhasa. And they started chasing down the princes of Song. The princes of Song were the political entity that supported the Karmapas. And Karmapa, being the Karmapa, they call him the knower of the three times, had warned the prince of Song like years earlier, "Hey, don't get crazy with these guys. It'll mean your death." He literally told him that. So he got crazy with them anyway. And guess what? The Mongols came in. They overran that province. And Karmapa left in that great caravan of his. And left his home monastery, Serpu. Because he realized he couldn't do anything else. He'd done all he could to pacify the situation. And that's the way it is for us. Just because we do everything right doesn't mean everything's going to go the way we want it to go. You still do everything right because it plants seeds and it helps things in the long run. But sometimes you just got to get out of Dodge. And he did. Mongols caught him. And they burnt down, literally destroyed the great encampment. So all of the treasures that were in the great encampment, all those huge tankas and all those ceremonial things that supported the Lama dances and the teachings as they moved through Tibet, destroyed. If you remember previous talks, that was all put together by the fourth Karmapa. So they'd been building this way of spreading the Dharma for a long time. And it was all destroyed. The 10th Karmapa ended up being in exile for 30 years. It was for 30 years until finally the Mongols left Tibet, because they had their own problems. You know, when you do bad stuff, eventually it catches up with you. And he came back and had to repair Serpu. It had been damaged a little bit. And he reconnected with the fifth Dalai Lama. And they became closer than ever. the attendant that had been actually difficult was replaced, get this, by one of the chief attendants of the Karmapa. And his name was Tewo Rinpoche. And, you know, the interesting thing was is that the 10th Karmapa was able to have last 10 years of his life at that point. Good activity. And he passed away and left the prediction letter, and the 11th Karmapa was born. He only lived for 26 years. But in that time, the 5th Dalai Lama died. And Tewo Rinpoche realized that the political delicacy of Tibet was so intensely delicate. They didn't want to tell anybody that the 5th Karmapa died. I mean, the 5th Dalai Lama died. So they ran the show for, like, I think it was 5 years or 6 years. There was no internet back then. There weren't even telephones. There weren't newspapers. There was nothing. So really, nobody knew. They didn't let word spread, and they kind of ran the show until they could be sure that things would remain stable and peaceful before the 6th Dalai Lama was found and installed. The importance of this is that the Karmapa never deviated from, the 10th Karmapa never deviated from this non-grasping mind. He stayed with kindness and compassion, even in the face of the Mongols. And because of that, it was able to plant a seed that ended up in the manifestation, really, of what became the Tibet from the 17th century on, that really supported and developed Buddhism and developed harmony between all the different lineages. That was not in the bag. So for us in our daily lives, I mean, we experience stress, but it's not quite like existential stress of your whole people, right? We experience it. And the way we do it, you know, things happen that we don't like, and it can be anything from getting cut off in traffic to bigger things like the death of a loved one or something, you know, loss of a job or something like that. And we can just feel ourselves contract like that. It's like stress does that. We feel like we're choking, can barely breathe. Have you ever been that uptight that your breath is short? You can do that watching the news these days, actually. The thing to do, though, when you get that now, is to do what the Karmapas did, which is to look and see, how am I, like, grasping after what I want, pleasure, or avoiding suffering? Where's that grasping at? It's like four styles of hope and fear, really. How am I grasping what I'm hoping for, trying to avoid what I fear? And sometimes you get what you want and you're still uptight. Why? Because you're afraid of losing it. You've been down that road before, right? How am I grasping on that? How am I avoiding what I fear? Fame and insignificance, you know, it's like, sure, I want everybody to like my Dharma talk, and I don't want to just be insignificant. I don't want this thing to be unimportant. To the degree that I regard this talk that way, I'll have a tightness in my day or not, or some freedom in my day. Praise and blame. Oh, I'd love it if Kempo Kartha Rinpoche sent me a note and said, oh, heard that was a good talk, you know. Oh, never happens, but, you know, you know. And to the degree I need that pat on the head, It's just a way of feeding my ego trip, right? It's difficult. Gain and loss happens all the time. We get stuff, and then we got to protect stuff, and then we want to get more stuff because we thought we had what we wanted, but it wasn't enough, and then we lose all the stuff. How did the Karmapa handle it when something that had been literally building his mission for centuries gets destroyed by the Mongols? It's important. If he would have gotten really uptight and depressed and gone to a cave and meditated at that point and ran away from everybody, even though we'd all think the Karmapa meditating was meritorious, it wouldn't have been a good thing. Not the right reaction. He had to get out there and actually liberate some energy in order to benefit us and to have something to pass on to the next Karmapa all the way down to this one. We're the same. So if we don't buy into this this style of hope and fear, if we can bring it our meditation to these experiences, these waves that we're having, it's likely that a lot more energy is tied up there than you know, and it can be liberated, and it can be liberated from this layer of uptightness we call the kleshic consciousness. And when it is liberated, it kind of becomes part of the ocean of our existence, which is way beyond this little ego of I, me, and mine. You see everything in the context of a much, much bigger kind of picture. Returning to that analogy of the wave, so if you say, I am angry, okay, you're taking that wave of anger and you're identifying yourself with that, right? What's the wave comprised of? Water. Where'd it come from? The ocean. Is there any difference? No. So it's a matter of what we're identifying with. This small little ouch cube that we call a self. Ouch! Or the source of all of it. And it's through meditation. It's through the teachings of the Buddha, or at least actually the practices that the Buddha taught, doing them ourselves, that we do what he did and what the Karmapas have done and liberate this life, living energy that's the most precious thing we own. I don't know if I could say own. I don't suppose we own it. This most precious thing, this living energy, it's like instead of having it in this little wave, releasing it into this ocean that supports all kinds of life out there, changes context. So I invite you, whenever you get a little bit stressed out this week, to look at it in terms of why. Who's stressed out? Well, I'm stressed out. Who am I? Would the ocean be stressed out about a wave? Yeah, not likely. So who am I? What caused that wave to arise? Oh, it was the winds of change pushing me, and it's not what I hoped for. Well, guess what? Change is not going away. And once you realize that, okay, the winds of change blew up this wave and it did its thing, and you let it go, it doesn't have a lot of staying power. The only thing that keeps it alive and keeps that staying power is the narrative. It's the story we tell ourselves about it. And believe me, you can create your own Les Miserables that's even better than, you know, what's on TV right now, or not. You can also create for yourself a path to enlightenment. And I think if you want to be a Buddhist, that's the point. That's what we're trying to do. So I hope that I covered all three of these subjects adequately enough. It's 25 after, and I want to leave a little bit of time for questions or comments or anything anybody might want to say. So if you would use the question, Mike, that would be great. That way, their recordings, their podcasts, that way people can hear.
Thank you for the talk, Eric.
Thanks, Don.
Just a comment based on your analogy of the wave. I saw a great quote on that Font of All Wisdom Facebook.
Ah, yes.
By Leonard Cohen.
I like Leonard, yes.
Who was a Buddhist.
Yes.
But the quote was, if you don't become the ocean, you'll be seasick every day.
That's right. I love that, yeah.
I use that as a reminder frequently.
Yeah. And the truth is, you are the ocean. I think waking up is just knowing that. When the wave wakes up, it realizes it's the ocean. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to say one other thing about that, too. You know, stress isn't all bad. It makes us stronger. It's like, I hope you get the point of it. This isn't about avoiding stress or avoiding anything. That was the point. It's like learning how to work with that is what gives us the strength and concentration to wake up. There, I found this thing and said, I was told that if you see a butterfly struggling to break out of a cocoon and try to ease its struggle by prying open the cocoon, that butterfly will emerge in a weakened state and may even die. So we need, you know, it's none of this is wasted. I just want to add that. Hi.
So I have a bit of a historical question.
Yeah.
The third Dalai Lama was appointed by the Mongols, right?
Sort of.
Yeah. Does that have any bearing on the fifth Dalai Lama, like his attendant wanting to invite the Mongols?
You know, maybe. Okay. There have been these relationships that go back. You know, the second Karmapa was famous. The second and third were famous for being the gurus to the Mongols. They were just there. They were always interested, and some of them were good guys and some of them weren't. The third Dalai Lama, if I remember right, was the first actually one called the Dalai Lama, and the name Dalai Lama came from the Mongols. And then they looked at his previous incarnations and figured out who the first and second were. And they all knew that Jay Tsongkhapa, who was a student of, I forget which Karmapa, but one of them, was the founder of that lineage. See what I mean? So it's all woven together. I think, you know, it's good to remember we're dealing with human enterprise here. And a lot of people don't like to say that, but it's true. And you can get lamas that, well, let's just say, have difficult incarnations or maybe aren't, you know, behaving the best. So I don't know if it was from that or not, you know. I think it might have just been somebody who was power hungry and saw that as a way to consolidate his own power. And he got caught in the eight worldly dharmas. You know, there are high lamas out there that probably don't practice properly. I don't know, but looking at behaviors, I think that may be the case. And I think that's all this was just a human folly.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, somebody taking advantage of a political situation for their own enrichment, so to speak. Actually, that happened to this Karmapa, and he talks about it in the address he gave the Munlam last year. It's online. You can read it. He doesn't hide anything about the human folly that has surrounded him. He sees it, and he's one of the first I can ever remember that says right out loud stuff that most people don't about, you know, we're all responsible for the path that we're on. We really are.
Well, thanks, Eric. I'm always happy when I know that you're speaking.
And thank you.
A lot. Yeah, it's you're on my level.
Well, that's a compliment. Thank you.
Not, but you're but my question is, I sort of formulating this while you're speaking, and somehow, like, human nature, we like to have an advantage, feel that we have an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some research, I can't remember where I heard this, like 80% of the people that are interviewed believe that they're smarter than most people, which mathematically is not.
How crazy is that?
Yeah. So we all kind of, you know, I've gone through a lot of my life desperately trying to feel like I had an advantage, you know,
mm-hmm.
a lot of my life, you know. And they're not, a lot of them are not been bad, you know, education and such like that, but trying to achieve things. As I've gotten older, you know, self-indulgent lifestyle or what have you, you know, as you get older, basically I realize that, you know, it's a lot of it, what I do is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like biological, the frog that croaks the loudest. You know, gets the mate or whatever. But there's still, I mean, I still at this point, I like to believe that I have an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Even coming here. You know, mm-hmm. It's like I got a better handle on things. I go to KTC. I try to, you know, or whatever. But so I don't really know exactly how, you know, a certain level, I think it is just sort of the rat race of survival.
Mm-hmm.
Is to somehow beat your chest and feel, you know, and convince other people that you're superior or whatever. So I think it is, I'm talking a long time, but there's this chimpanzees. This one chimpanzee, he found that when he got pots and pans, he's smaller than the other chimpanzees, but it's out in the wild. He got a whole pot and pans. He's banging them together, and they all like treated him like he was their leader, you know, because he's scared. Mm-hmm. And so he had that advantage. You know, I think. Some of it, a lot of it is smoke and mirrors that we do. But I don't know if it's – I feel like it's necessary for me to have a certain delusion in the belief of having an advantage. And I don't know, really know how to even really address that in myself.
That's actually insightful. I think we all have that. I have two – over the years – because of the grace of two very great meditation teachers that I've been lucky enough to have. I have two aspirations I carry in my each hip pocket, one in each, that I try to cultivate every day. You know, I meditate on these things as part of my practice. One is to cultivate the wish to grow, which is a little different than wanting to have an advantage. I find that if I have this sense that I'm growing all the time, that feeling of needing an advantage drops. There's, in Buddhist psychology, there's the family, it's the karma family. The head Buddha is a Mogacity, and the karmic poison it's known to deal with, a Mogacity is known to deal with, is jealousy. Wanting to have an advantage actually comes from thinking you don't have an advantage, right? And so that tends to be jealousy, and jealousy is poisonous. Amoghacitti, the psychology is the flip side. The wisdom of transforming jealousy is what's called all-accomplishing wisdom. Once you recognize your own Buddha nature, you realize that you don't have to worry about having a disadvantage or an advantage. That binary thing kind of drops. And the only thing that matters at that point is having a wish to grow. You know, kind of grow into yourself as the Buddha that you are. The other aspiration I hold is for the benefit of all beings. that if I'm acting for the benefit of all beings, I don't seem to need to worry too much about whether I'm the highest of the high or the lowest of the low. It tends to be when I'm worrying about me is when I have that. And you're right, instinctively, I want to have an advantage and I want to be the winner. But, you know, that's actually this idea that there's that I that needs to win. That's what the Buddha called fundamental ignorance. So as a follower of the Buddha, I just try to work on this wish to grow for the benefit of all beings. And slowly, 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 this mental habit kind of unknots itself, and that energy is released and goes in the direction of my aspirations. So it's really important to make aspirations. It's really important to have vast and great aspirations because they actually will direct how your consciousness is going. Psychologists call it neuroplasticity. We're constantly programming the mind, you know. And so if we program it with a wish to grow and for the benefit of all beings, then it's going to go that way naturally and slowly, 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 some of this instinctive reptilian brain will unwind itself. But not through work, through relaxation, you know? That's the thing. You ever watch a snake unwind itself when it's all tied up in knots? Nobody unties it. It just relaxes and it comes out. Same thing with our reptilian brain. It's all tied in knots. And part of meditation is undoing the knots. Well, as usual, I'm over time. So let's dedicate the merit. I brought a special dedication that I would like to read to you all. And then after, if you want to come up, I can give you a copy of this sutra if you would like to have it. This virtue is dedicated to all beings that they may resolutely travel the immortal inner path and realize Buddhahood by unifying wisdom and method as permanent bliss within the indestructible mind. Through this merit, may I swiftly attain Mahamudra and bring all beings without exception to that state. Through the blessing of attaining the three Buddhakayas, the truth of the unchanging Dharmata, and the limitless resolve of the Sangha, may this dedication and aspiration be fulfilled. May whatever I experience, wealth or poverty, health or illness, bad or good reputation, living or dying, even being born in a hell realm, may any action I do from now on with my body, speech, or mind become most beneficial. May anyone who touches me, sees me, and remembers me, talks to me, who praises or criticizes me, just by this, may they never be reborn into the lower realms, and may they immediately be liberated from all diseases, harm, negative karma, and defilements. May they quickly achieve enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.